You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about a couple who started a second career after losing their jobs. They got into the ice cream business. First, a few weeks ago, data from state health officials showed that Wisconsin's infant mortality rate has stayed steady for the past few years. The number of infant deaths has stayed in line with and at times lower than the national average. But the picture of infant health in Wisconsin is more complicated than it may seem, particularly when it comes to disparities. And Dr. Deborah Ehrenthal is with us now. She researches health disparities and is associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And she joins me now to talk more about this infant mortality rate in Wisconsin. And Dr. Ehrenthal, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So where does the infant infant mortality rate in Wisconsin stand right now?
When we look at the rate in Wisconsin, we look at the total number of infants who die before their first birthday or within their first year of life, and that's considered the infant mortality rate. And when we look at the rate here in Wisconsin, we see that it's been fairly stable for the past decade. There's some improvements, but we haven't seen the improvements here as have been seen in some other states across the United States.
So what is happening here that's different than the rest of the U.S.?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because many of these trends are really difficult to disentangle because it's so hard to get data for such large populations. There have been, over the course of the past century, strategies that have led to improvements in health that we can point to that start from simple things like clean water and better living conditions, and then move to strategies that we use to increase the likelihood that a baby who's born prematurely will survive. And that's typically related to health care. So much of the trend that we have seen over the past 100 years have been related to these very large changes that we've experienced in the U.S. When we look at where we are now, we're looking at other strategies that can help us continue to lower these rates, which are at historical lows. Strategies that have been used in Wisconsin mirror in some ways strategies that have been used elsewhere, but there are other forces working against them that I think are probably responsible for the differences that we're seeing in our trends.
Okay, so what are some of the forces working against these strategies that seem to be effective elsewhere?
Well, one of the things that we all need to remember is that health is really driven by a lot of different factors. Individual behaviors are a small piece of it, maybe 30%, and healthcare accounts for about 20%. But a large driver of outcomes are related to social and economic circumstances, and that may be a place where we're seeing differences in our trends, especially when we look at disparities by among populations.
And when we're talking about the infant mortality rates, are most of the cases that we're talking about, are they related to premature births, or are they deaths that may happen after birth?
That's a great question. So prematurity is probably the leading cause of mortality across the U.S. It's number one. There are different ways of counting it. Congenital anomalies or birth defects are also big drivers, but most consider prematurity to be the main driver. So prematurity, congenital anomalies, and then maternal illness, which can also lead to premature birth and therefore death. So prematurity is a large driver. We also know that there are other causes that lead to later deaths, and most people think a lot about SIDS, which is one of the common causes.
And so if we're talking about the majority coming from premature and congenital issues there, are we looking more at issues of mother's health and health care during pregnancy?
It's a great question. So mother's health during pregnancy and the life that she leads during pregnancy are really key. But her health is sort of the culmination of factors that have impacted her through her life. So absolutely, it's very related to mother's health and then the healthcare system that can help support her baby if born prematurely.
Well, I guess put another way, are these mothers who are experiencing this infant mortality with their infants, are they receiving the healthcare that they need to to support them during the pregnancy? Are they having access, and are they using the health care when it's there?
That's a great question. One of the things that we haven't talked about, which I think will be useful here, is to think about the populations or the women who have the worst outcomes in Wisconsin. And where we see the most dramatic disparities are among babies born to Black women. There we see nearly three times the rate of infant mortality as we do to babies born to white women. So what's the cause? Well, healthcare might be a piece of it. We see significantly lower rates of early entry into prenatal care among populations who have poor outcomes, among women who are Black or who live in settings where there's concentrated poverty.
And are there locuses in Wisconsin where you see this and where you see these rates highest? Where do you see it happening?
The rates of infant mortality are highest in southeast Wisconsin, where the African-American women, where most African-American babies are born.
So when you look at that area, there are other socioeconomic issues you were talking about, lots of those things at play, education outcome gaps and poverty and issues of incarceration. Do you see that all being interconnected when we talk about one piece of the puzzle maybe here?
That's a great question. I think it's very much a cycle. And I think they are all connected. And that's a really important observation to make. Women's health is driven as she becomes a woman of reproductive age by the circumstances around her, by the strength of the healthcare system, but probably even more strongly by the stress and the economic pressures on her before she has a baby. An interesting observation is that women who have planned pregnancies have much better outcomes than women who have unplanned pregnancies. And that's potentially related to the stability of her life at the time the child is born.
So you're saying stress can play a factor into this. How do you see that playing out? Take an example for us and introduce us to someone like this.
Introduce you to someone like this. So a woman who is in school, maybe hasn't finished high school, who is living in a unstable house, with unstable housing, moves around a lot with her family, moves a lot around a lot independent of her family, is experiencing a lot of stress in her life. She may have inadequate nutrition, and she may not be as connected to healthcare as she might. And if she carries a child through that stressful period in her life, that the stress seems to be related to the spontaneous prematurity that we're seeing and that is so tightly connected to the mortality that we see.
We're talking right now about Wisconsin's infant mortality rate with Dr. Deborah Ehrenthal from UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we've been talking about the disparities here in the rate between, in particular, between African Americans and whites when it comes to this infant mortality rate. There's a striking gap there, I know, that you're looking at. And what do you suggest moving forward to try to close this gap?
The gap is complicated. And some of this gap is related to health. And some of the gap is related to health care, and some of it is related to the strength and cohesiveness of communities. And we need to be thinking about all of these factors when we develop strategies to try to improve outcomes. Health care is a strategy that we all understand. And the efforts to increase access to health care and ensure high-quality health care is really key. But we also need to be thinking about how we can help support the lives of young women and young families to create a more safe and stable setting so that they can reduce the stress of their lives to improve the outcomes of their kids.
And just briefly, are there examples of communities that are on this track we can look to as a model for how to support people like this?
There are a lot of communities across the country that are working to try to impact the lives of families. There are some place-based initiatives that are being developed in New York City, in Oakland, California, to try to improve to decrease the stress of the environment women and their families are living in. Here in Wisconsin, we're working with communities in Milwaukee, Racine, and Kenosha to implement the community's priority strategies to try to make a difference here.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Deborah Ehrenthal. She's an associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and she joined us here in studio to talk about racial disparities in Wisconsin's infant mortality rate. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at whether College for All or a focus on technical training will serve workers and the economy in the 21st century. But now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Summer is winding down in Wisconsin, and many people are making their final pilgrimages to lake homes and to cabins up north. But one couple has found a way to enjoy summer weather all year round.
Hi there.
Hello.
Inside the boxy white walls of her ice cream truck, Diane Steflug takes orders through the window.
Large waffle of raspberry.
While her husband John scoops mint chocolate chip and black raspberry into cups and cones. They're such a well-oiled machine, they might as well have been serving frozen treats all their lives. But actually, the Steflugs didn't become business owners until they were well into their 50s.
Our income changed drastically. Our foundation that we had been building was now gone.
It started 8 years ago. When the recession hit in late 2007, John lost his job working in IT. He couldn't find work. Nobody wanted to hire an employee so close to retirement. So like a lot of much younger folks who are choosing lifestyle perks over profit margin, the couple decided they might as well gamble on a new career that promised a more relaxed atmosphere.
And we said, oh, now we can have fun and be working.
I was only 58 at the time. So I couldn't retire yet. But, you know, you can't find a new job at that age either. We need to do something, you know. We didn't want to sit around and do nothing. So we started this.
They bought an ice cream business and moved from Milwaukee to St. Germain in rural northern Wisconsin, where they had a second home. Beautiful summer weather and a slower pace of life sounded pretty good to the pair of city dwellers. And when winter set in all too soon, the Steflugs decided to take their freezer and head south to their other favorite vacation spot, Naples, Florida.
It was such a big hit that we just kept going back, and we now spend 6 months in Wisconsin and 6 months in Florida selling the ice cream.
Now they're earning a living and enjoying year-round sunshine. They haven't shoveled snow in over 7 years.
The longer you're away from the Wisconsin winter, the more you appreciate not being in the winter months in Wisconsin. We become wimps.
But it isn't all sunshine and sweet treats. Scooping thousands of cones each weekend takes its toll. And a traditional retirement lifestyle is looking better and better.
I'm starting to have more and more aches and pains. We do a couple music festivals where it starts at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon and you're there till 1 o'clock in the morning. It's starting to get a little bit rough. We're not bouncing back as fast as we used to.
Would you go back to your old life if you could?
I don't think so. It's too much stress. You know, there's a lot more stress in that life than this life, you know.
You know, there's many days where our outfit for the day is flip-flops, a T-shirt, and a pair of shorts. It would be probably harder to go from this back than it was from that to this.
When it does come time to retire, they'll be able to split their time between vacation spots without thinking about the bottom line.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik and is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. For many adults, life's changing circumstances can call for the need to find a second career, and often the process of working toward that goal can be difficult to navigate. Rob Ferret spoke with Jeffrey Russell, Vice Provost for Lifelong Learning and Dean of Continuing Studies at UW-Madison, who offered some advice and resources for those looking to continue their education.
Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate you having us on the show.
Well, a lot of people, if we think about college students this time of year, we're thinking of those new high school graduates entering their freshman year. Tell us about the other students, though, the people you see in your program. Who are they?
Well, we're really excited to be a place where every person in the state and beyond can connect to the university. So this isn't a residential piece, as you were referring to, in terms of all the new students mm-hmm. moving in. But the chance for all of the listeners to identify with UW-Madison as a lifelong learner, and as you indicated, it goes all the way from personal enrichment to perhaps needing to acquire some new workplace skills in a changing economy.
And what kind of services and programs can people in that situation find with continuing studies there?
Well, we've got a number of things. One is that we've got an adult and career service office that can help people think about perhaps making a transition in their career, think about some additional skills that they might want to pick up, perhaps they want to complete their degree. In other cases, it's much more around the personal enrichment side, where folks are really interested in engaging, whether it's arts, creative writing, perhaps it's a foreign language, and it's really about the quality of life and the ability to continue to develop themselves around some of those areas of interest.
Let's start with that first group you mentioned, people looking for that either a new career or maybe doing things to certify them to move up in their current career. How common is that among the people who come to you for resources?
Well, I think as you're probably reading, like a lot of the listeners, I mean, the economy is got a lot of different issues in terms of the continued development of skills if you're between transitions or perhaps there's new technology that's being introduced. So we've got a number of things from credit-based certificates to more accessible master's degree programs to non-credit programs that might help build skills in a given area that would help somebody choose a new career or perhaps enhance their skills in their current career.
And you mentioned accessibility. A lot of people in this position aren't going to be able to, you know, move into the dorm like the freshmen and stop everything and start this new program. How are these programs built around people's work lives, parenting lives, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that's the really exciting thing that we're working on, recognizing that it's flexibility and access are two important pieces that particularly the adult learner is confronted with. And so what we're really trying to do is to figure out ways in evenings and weekends and where it makes sense in an online format to make it flexible and yet accessible for these high-quality learning experiences.
So for someone wanting to do this with employment in mind, what sort of questions should they be asking themselves to figure out what kind of educational program would be right for them?
Well, I think that if they would come in and sit down with some of our counselors here, the first couple of questions are going to really deal with their interests and passions and where do they see themselves and what kind of things are they really motivated by. And then it's a matter of figuring out what's the appropriate educational experiences that are going to make sense for them, and then figuring out then how to find that. And that might not always be available here at UW-Madison, but it's important to try to connect them with the appropriate educational resources that are going to help them advance in their learning and advance in their career planning.
Talking to Jeffrey Russell, he's Vice Provost for Lifelong Learning and Dean of Continuing Studies at UW-Madison about going back to school, getting some kind of education, even if you're not that new freshman at a UW system school, say. Now let's go to the other side we started with, Jeffrey, the lifelong learners. Who are we talking about there?
Well, the beauty is that's all of us, and hopefully everybody that's listening can identify with that. And whether we're in formal schooling or not, I think we're all on a journey to continue to build our knowledge and skills in a variety of areas.
And what kind of programs do you see people coming back to learn, even if they're not related to their work life?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of interest in the humanities, the whole notion of the human expression, whether it's art, whether it's creative writing, whether it's the languages that they want to learn, whether it's art, dancing, art, a whole variety of areas like that that we see a number of folks interested in, as well as the workplace skills.
And we now have this internet thing. How much of an online presence does a program like yours have?
Well, it's clearly growing. I think that's the real exciting work that we're undertaking now, is that we've got to increase access, and we can't allow people totally to be place-bound. And with the ability to have some virtual communities, we can really increase inclusion in the diversity and the number of options that are available. So we see this growing over time. Our non-credit courses would probably be about 15% are online, and we're offering over 50 different accessible post-bachelor's programs. In a large share of those, a large number are online.
And I understand you have a new program, a Living Well Today and Tomorrow. Tell us about that.
Well, we're trying to really look at this basic notion of quality of life, and it means many, many different things: emotionally, being involved in other ways to express interest and meaning. And so we're really excited to get this started and explore how this can help make a difference in people's lives.
Now, can you make the case for us that we should all be lifelong learners and think of ourselves and act like lifelong learners?
Well, I think that, you know, when you step away from traditional learning and the assessment piece of it, these are things that are driven by your interest and passion. And I think that that puts a little bit different perspective on it, where people are really trying to acquire things because of their own curiosity and interest. So I think it's really important that we shape the learning that recognizes people have different life experiences, and they bring that to the learning, and they learn from each other. And I think that's what just really makes community important, whether it's here locally on campus or at another location, because we do learn in community, and we are connected to one another. There's just tremendous opportunities for all of us to grow and develop.
Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, well, have a good day.
That was Jeffrey Russell, the Vice Provost for Lifelong Learning and Dean of Continuing Studies at UW-Madison, talking to Central Times' Rob Ferret about continuing education and second careers. Coming up, we look at what skills are needed by a 21st century workforce and how to make sure students learn them. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 7, it's Reveal. This week, Reveal revisits an hour with Mother Jones reporter Shane Bauer inside a private prison on lockdown. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network. First, there's been a lot of talk during this year's political campaigns about American jobs going overseas and college becoming unaffordable. On this Labor Day holiday, it's a good time to revisit an interview from May with Catherine Newman. She's the provost and senior vice chancellor for academic affairs at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she co-wrote the book Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. Newman says the problem isn't that there aren't enough jobs here. It's that America's employees aren't being trained or prepared to fill some of those vacant jobs. And a lot of the available jobs are middle-skill jobs that require vocational training, not a four-year degree. Rob Ferret spoke with Catherine Newman earlier this year.
Part of the core problem, Catherine, you're saying is we've got jobs out there. We've got businesses that want to create more jobs. We don't have the skilled workforce to meet those needs. How big a problem is this?
It's a pretty big problem. In manufacturing alone, there are some 600,000 jobs that have not been filled for lack of people who have the right skills. And we have a workforce that is aging, and when they retire, we're going to have even fewer people stepping up behind them. So we need people in mechatronics, in advanced manufacturing, in information technology. There's a long list of career areas that pay well and that require education, both training and education in high school and beyond, especially in community colleges, of the kind that our European counterparts are investing in very heavily, but we are not, and we need to if we're going to remain a competitive country.
Yeah, part of the case you're making is that we've set an educational priority on getting as many kids to four-year college as possible, and you say at the expense of that kind of vocational training. What's led to that philosophy?
Well, I think that there has been a long-standing skepticism, or maybe I should say an episodic skepticism, about vocational training. In part, it's part of the long debate that goes all the way back to W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, who argued vociferously about whether training for pragmatic economic opportunity was more important or less important than training for liberal arts education. Both are important. Both are important pathways. And the great genius of American higher education is that it offers choice to people, and choices that don't necessarily slam the doors in people's faces as they consider alternatives as they move through the lifespan. So I think, however, this collided with a post-World War II romance with white-collar employment, which tended to lead through the gates of universities. Universities do very important work to educate our population, to create good citizens, and to prepare people for certain parts of the labor market. But the technical training I'm talking about in Reskilling America is absolutely critical if we're going to be at the top of manufacturing or IT or any of the new emerging areas, and that isn't necessarily what four-year universities can do. So we need both, not either or.
Part of that skepticism you mentioned, and you talk about this some in your book, is maybe a fear that, okay, we're taking people at a fairly young age, high school age, maybe even younger, and saying, you're college bound, you're white collar job bound, you guys over here and girls over here, you are bound for blue collar jobs. And people don't want to have that intentional class sorting, I guess, in our educational system.
That this is where a lot of the skepticism comes from. But if we really look at what happens, especially to young people who are coming out of high schools that don't prepare them very well for your college education, what actually happens to them when they seek that pathway is that they end up often deeply mired in debt. They don't complete their education. It doesn't leave them with the kinds of skills that are necessary for them to earn a good living. And very often they're coming out of communities that desperately need people, especially young men, to have good job prospects so they can support themselves and their families. We don't give them that alternative. We give them only one alternative. And the statistics on their success rates can be very troubling. So I am not advocating that we shut the door to college education. No one in my position would. But I do think we need to open up alternatives so that these possibilities that are going begging can be filled by people who need good jobs with a good future.
Talking to Catherine Newman. She's co-author of the new book, Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. I want to look at some real-world examples. I mean, Germany is famous for vocational training, but you say we don't need to cross the Atlantic. Talk about the New York Aviation High School as an example of what you're talking about.
Aviation High School was founded in 1936. It was very much a child of the New Deal, and it has been absolutely instrumental in creating a skilled labor force for the aircraft industry and for the airline industry. It's trained countless pilots, technicians, people who have been very successful contributors to the major airlines. And it's been doing that, again, since 1936. The teachers who are there today, many of them are veterans of the military and of the aviation industry, and they come back to teach in the high school because they really love the place. The students, there are thousands of students who try to get into this school. It's a regular public school, and they very often commute for an hour and a half on the subway just to be able to gain access to this education. They have regular Regents diplomas, but they also train for the airline and aircraft industry, and they can come out with a certificate, which if they had to purchase this on the open market, purchase this training, it would cost them $30,000 or $40,000. So it's a very successful school, very highly motivated students, very motivated teachers, but as is true of many vocational programs, is working with out-of-date equipment, with an inability to place students in the kind of internships they need to get real-world experience. So they're really hobbled by lack of investment, but no lack of enthusiasm or talent.
I want to bring things home to Wisconsin. You spend a little time on Wisconsin in your book. On the one hand, critiquing the state for budget cuts to some of the smaller schools, technical colleges, smaller UW system colleges that could do this kind of thing. But also, you see positive examples in an apprenticeship program in the state. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, Wisconsin has been one of the pioneers, along with some of the surprising states in the Southeast that have also been pioneers, where they've recognized, at least periodically, that apprenticeship was very important, that this kind of technical training in regional settings was important. So Wisconsin has been one of the states out there in front of this wave. But even in Wisconsin, the support has not been steady enough. And this is part of the problem we see. There, we have periods of excitement about this model, and then periods in which it just dies off. I've been interviewed by other radio stations where people have said to me, couldn't we have had this interview in 1993? And the answer is yes, we could have, because that was an earlier period in which we fell in love with this idea. So we don't just need to invest in it. We need to do this in a way that is consistent, consistent in all the states, consistent in the federal government, and not just discovered when we're in the middle of a recession and high unemployment. If it isn't consistent, then the training is not of sufficient quality and people can't depend on it.
Catherine, suppose November comes, we have a president-elect, they call you and say, Catherine, we like this idea of yours. What are the key steps to making an effective vocational education system in this country? What has to be included?
What has to be included is robust budgets for vocational education, which costs money in terms of technology, and we also need to reward teachers for investing in their own skills in these areas. We need to enable them to work in those industries in the summertime and come back to the academic year with the kinds of experience and state-of-the-art understanding of new technologies, as well as connections they can then give to their talented students to help them get jobs. We need to partner vocational and technical education with apprenticeship. These aren't the same thing, and they really work best when they're melded together. So during the school day, you have all of the academic side, the sort of basics in math and physics and human communication skills, but the job skills that you get from working on the shop floor as an apprentice are a critical part of this. And so we do have some schools in the U.S., including here in Massachusetts, where students work for a week with employers, and then they come back to school for a week. That kind of sandwich model can work. There are other models, especially in places like South Carolina, where the students in four or five feeder high schools come to a central technical training college in the afternoon. So they're in their regular high schools in the morning and in the technical college in the afternoon and have a sort of a split schedule, if you will. That model works too. There are many different models, but I think the most important thing, the lesson we learned from looking at Germany, for example, is it's the combination of steady, high quality, and demanding vocational and technical education with real world experience through apprenticeship.
We're talking with Catherine Newman, co-author of Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. She says there's a high demand for middle-skill, vocationally trained workers and a low supply of them in America. And we want to hear from you. Do you think college for all is the best way to bridge wealth inequality? Should we start focusing more on technical education? What do you think the role of education should be? Is it more about getting skills to enter the workforce, or should it be more about human development and growth? Post your thoughts and see what others have to say on the Central Time Facebook page. On this Labor Day holiday, we're revisiting an interview that Central Time's Rob Ferret did earlier this year on preparing young people so that they're ready to fill the jobs that are going unfilled. It's a look at America's workforce and the mismatch that our guest sees between the manufacturing jobs available and the skills of workers. Catherine Newman is with us. She's Provost and Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she's co-author of the book Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. And we want to know whether you think we should focus on teaching American students more vocational skills, or if you think that we should make four-year college an option for everyone. And what about making an effort to create more on-the-job training opportunities for young people? Let us know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Catherine, before we get to our callers, wanted to ask about how do we know what the needs are going to be in the future. I worry that, you know, at some point in American history, there could have been a horse and buggy vocational program or a computer punch card vocational program where students learn skills that become obsolete. How do we know we're on top of the times?
Your point is well taken, and this is why I think it's so important to involve industry in advising schools and to enable teachers to move back and forth between the world of work and the world of education. We tend to keep those things fairly hermetically sealed from one another, but that's not true everywhere in the world. We see in Japan a lot more coordination between teachers and industry. And by the way, I don't just mean manufacturing. There are many other kinds of industry and both for-profit and non-profit opportunities out there than just manufacturing. But I do think we need a teacher labor force that's kept well-informed about how new technologies are moving forward. And we also, one of the reasons we need apprenticeship so much isn't just for the contacts that it gives young people, but firms are in a very powerful position to introduce them to the most recent technologies. They don't stay in business if they're behind the curve. So we can't really expect schools to be continuously investing in new equipment. They really aren't financially enabled to do that, but firms are. They have to. And that's why we need young people to have an opportunity to work on the shop floor so they are continuously being trained in new technologies. And that's about as much sort of forecasting as we're really able to do, but it's certainly true that we need to be on the lookout for the ways in which the world is changing economically and in terms of new forms of production and try to stay on top of those curves and invent new ones ourselves.
Let's go to our callers. Joe on the line here in Wisconsin. Joe, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I'm a former university instructor, became redundant, and I decided to take advantage of my state of Ohio Workforce Investment Act funds, and I became a truck driver. And I'm rolling through your fine state right now. But I want to know, what do we do to address the, I call it irresponsible recruiting of these universities? I heard you mention before, you know, they're getting into, they're not graduating, they don't have the skill set. How do we address that gross mass out of control recruiting, which, you know, come to college, your future. How do we address that? Because I think that's a big part of the problem.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Catherine, I'm assuming given your job at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, you have a perspective on that. What do you think?
I certainly do. Well, we do, of course, encourage students to come our way, and they are extremely well qualified. It's a highly competitive university to get into, and I'm very proud of the work that our students do, but we're not involved in uncontrolled growth. I think we do owe it to students, all of us do as a society, to provide them with clear options and an understanding of where those options lead. The biggest problems in higher education are not really with the nonprofits or the University of Wisconsin. They're with the for-profits that do heavily recruit and are often very misleading in what they tell students they will be able to do with those credentials, and they do indebt them up to their eyeballs. So the biggest student debt problems are not in the conventional colleges and universities we all know about. They're in the for-profit industry that has worked very hard to capture federal dollars for their students. They, too, can do a good job on occasion, but we have a lot more fly-by-night for-profits than we ought to have. So I think our biggest problems can be controlled in that respect by truth in advertising in the for-profit sector.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joe. We'll go next to Jamie on the line in Milwaukee. Jamie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in, the phrase comes to me, on-the-job training, which is something, I'm 67, I heard that when I was younger. It's not an apprenticeship, it's not a vocational school, it's someone entering a company at an entry-level position and getting training within that company on the site. And I wonder, does that even exist anymore, or are those companies depending on the apprenticeships and the vocational schools to do that?
Jamie, thanks a lot for that call. So, Catherine, should companies be doing this for themselves, not putting this on the school system?
Well, it would be helpful if companies were more supportive of what the school system is trying to do and to invest in apprenticeship. In the European model, companies pay apprentices. So the training on the school side might be provided by the state supporting schools, but apprentices are usually paid for by companies who often turn around and ask community colleges, technical colleges to help with the training process. This is particularly important if you are a small business owner, because providing robust training when you're just a tiny company can be very, very difficult financially. But if you can work together with other employers in a career program or technical training program that's regional, you can take advantage of that economy of scale. all companies do on-the-job training. Truthfully, there's only so much that any school or even training program can do to provide the tailored skills that someone needs when they're working for us on a very specific piece of equipment or with a company that has a specific kind of computer program or something of that sort. But apprenticeship is really something in the middle. It does expose people to training that's provided by the firm because the apprentices are in the firm learning from more skilled, advanced, and seasoned workers. And that's who the teachers are. And this is very well developed in Germany, where young people starting at the age of 16 or 17 will start one of these dual vocational programs. And in the first year, they spend most of the week in school and only some of the week in the companies that are apprenticing them. But as they move into the second year, it flips over, and they're spending most of the week in the company and only some of it in school. But when they're on the shop floor, they have what's called a Meister or master teacher. That person is usually somebody who's put in 20 years on the shop floor. So that's a worker who has a lot of educational, a lot of applied experience, and they are transmitting it to a cohort of young people who've come in to work with them or train with them. That's really the model that I think is the best.
Jamie, thanks for that call. We're talking to Catherine Newman. Her new book is Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. Talk about vocational education. We'll go next to Kurt on the line in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hi.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. The guest, Catherine, is making excellent points, and she just touched on part of the problem and solution when she referred again to the German system, but she has to go the rest of the way. The problem is not only training for student and skilled workers. We had that until it was piece by piece, taken apart by corporations that just dropped. The culture in Germany is that workers, skilled workers, are highly honored, have been for centuries. Here, the corporate sector treats workers as dispensable resources. When they change their plans, the workers become irrelevant.
Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get Catherine Newman in before we're out of time. Part of this is culture. We need to, he's saying, respect skilled workers more.
I totally agree with him, and in fact, they are very skilled and they are very respected in countries like Germany. And in fact, the wage gap between skilled blue-collar and skilled white-collar work is very narrow in Germany because all of these people are regarded as important and respected. And I do think that that would go a long way both to destigmatize vocational education and to increase our intake of young people if they felt that that was a respected alternative.
Thanks a lot for that call. Catherine, in our last just under a minute, are people listening? Do you think people want to take this message and run with it and boost our vocational education?
I do think they're listening. Of course, they've listened before, and we've had this episodic pattern of interest, and then it disappears or wanes. I do think they're listening in part because I think the recession of 2008 was so powerful and had such a negative impact on millions of young people, especially in inner-city communities, but really all over the country. And we have the continuing spectacle of declining work opportunities for blue-collar workers. And I think we've all come to recognize that college for all, well, is fine for many, many people, will not do the trick for the whole country, and that we need to look in other directions if we're really going to recover the kind of robust employment and economic vitality for the future.
Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Catherine Newman. She's the co-author of Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century.